Economists, yes or no? Discuss amongst yourselves. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 4th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will begin today with a very quick, I promise, very quick reality check on the trade war. Our measurement of choice this Wednesday is known informally as the trade gap, the imbalance between what we buy from overseas and what we sell abroad. The good people at the Census Bureau and the Department of Commerce told us this morning that our goods and services trade deficit actually shrank a tiny bit in July from a month earlier. In and of itself, as we have reported, lo these many years, that is a macroeconomic non-issue. Mostly, trade deficits aren't necessarily good or bad. They just are. Because when we send our hundreds of billions of dollars to, say, China, we get stuff in return. That's the way global trade works. But, and I know, I promised, very quick, this tidbit from the report this morning. So far this year, we are importing almost 13% less stuff from China than we were at the same point a year ago. And our exports to China are down a bit more than 17%. You hear all the talk about a global slowdown? That is a global slowdown. One other quick indicator before the day's corporate story. More from Stephen Beard on this in a minute. But the British pound is having a bang-up day, thank you very much, as Parliament says not just no, but heck no to Boris Johnson and a no-deal Brexit, sterling up more than 1% today against the dollar. All right, moving on. $170 million is what it's going to cost Google to make good on YouTube's illegal gathering of data on what children are watching and then targeting those kids with ads. Fines payable to the Federal Trade Commission and New York State, along with a promise from the company to do more to protect kids' privacy. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, no website is supposed to collect data about kids under 13 without their parents' consent. The FTC found that YouTube was collecting that data and then using it to target children. Stacey Steinberg with the Juvenile Law Clinic at the University of Florida says YouTube did it by monitoring the comments kids made on videos.
Watching what it is that kids are interested in. What is the next video that the child clicks on? All of these are ways that the advertising that gets delivered to the child is more personal, more targeted, and really, as a result, more influential.
And more profitable. YouTube earned millions from advertisers by tracking kids, according to the FTC. Catherine Montgomery with the Center for Digital Democracy says the fine is tiny compared to the billions Alphabet, YouTube's parent company, makes in a year.
The fine is just not adequate enough to make a big dent at all in the profits of this company.
YouTube agreed to stop gathering information about viewers of children's videos and plans to turn off comments on that content. But the settlement doesn't address what YouTube can do with the data it's already collected. Sarita Schoenbeck with the University of Michigan School of Information says even if it isn't used immediately to market to kids,
it seems very likely that it will be kept and used in the future when they're 13, when they're 16, when they're 18, in different ways and sold in different ways as well.
YouTube has agreed to implement the changes by next year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Quick footnote to Erica's story. She alluded to it. Here's the full context. The fine today, as she said, $170 million. Google's revenue for 2018, $136 billion with a B dollars. Remember back as the financial crisis was really getting going when Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were basically taken over by the government? And if you don't remember, trust me, it was a big deal in no small part because those two companies either own or guarantee more than half the mortgages in this economy. Any day now, the Trump administration is expected to announce its plan for setting Fannie and Freddie free, or semi-free, you might say. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
Way back in 2008, when then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced a temporary timeout for Fannie and Freddie,
I turned to the person next to me and said my under-over was 20 years in conservatorship.
That's Edward Golding, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. 11 years later, he's still not holding his breath. It's hard to undo things, Golding says, especially when the status quo is working pretty well.
Consumers can get mortgages at reasonable rates, and the liquidity of the mortgage-backed security market, in fact, has improved.
So why mess with an actually pretty okay situation? Well, the companies themselves would like to control their own fates and finances. Right now, they're handing $15 to $20 billion a year in profits over to the U.S. Treasury. Conservatives want to get taxpayers off the hook for any future losses and open the market to private competition. Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance, says an ideal scenario for now would be to take the companies out of conservatorship,
allow them to build up sufficient capital so that they don't pose a risk to taxpayers, and at the same time preserve their existing operations that support housing the way we're seeing right now.
But he's not holding his breath either. Though the Trump administration could release Fannie and Freddie on its own, Congress would have to pass more substantial reform. The Senate Banking Committee has scheduled a hearing early next week. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, the algorithms were pleased. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The tally for Boris Johnson is now 4 parliamentary votes held during his prime ministership, 4 votes lost. Yesterday, it was losing control of the parliamentary agenda. Today, it was not being able to stop a bill that outlaws a no-deal departure from the European Union. And then late on a London evening, not being able to convince Parliament to agree to a snap election. So, uncertainty, thy name continues to be Brexit. And while all of that hangs in the balance, remember that the European Union is Britain's biggest trading partner. So a trade deal with the United States becomes all the more important. President Trump has promised the prime minister, and this is a quote, a big, quick and beautiful deal. But there are some sticking points, and among them are food safety, animal welfare and health care. From the Edenbridge Agricultural Show in the southern county of Surrey, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on that one.
Away you go. Winner here today.
This is one of the most prestigious farm shows in Britain. Every summer, hundreds of rural types turn up here to show off their prowess, their produce, and their pride and joy. In the cattle tent, Graham Powell is pampering his prize cows, standing next to them with a bucket to catch their droppings so they don't soil their bedding straw.
They go in the ring, they've got to look their best. That is why we clean up behind them.
You're going to have to clean that back end then, are you?
Yes, yes.
That's a labour of love.
It is, it is, it is.
Ben, can I have some tissue, please?
Doting on his animals, Powell says he's all in favour of a free trade deal with the US with one important proviso.
If America wishes to adopt higher welfare standards and offer a level playing field, then that's great, let's go for it. You know, that's competition, that's fair.
Under EU regulations, Britain has banned imports from the US of hormone-treated beef and poultry rinsed in chlorine, claiming they involve lower standards of animal welfare and even less food safety. Alan Bishop, another cattle farmer here, is also nervous about unfettered free trade with the US.
I don't think we should be importing anything that doesn't meet our standards.
What do you think the impact would be on farmers like you if hormone-treated beef did flood into Britain from the US?
It'd be a lot cheaper, and it'd be very hard for our market to compete with it.
The US dismisses this as protectionism, pointing out there's no evidence of a health risk from American produce and insisting the US takes animal welfare as seriously as the Brits. But perception is everything when it comes to selling a trade deal to the public. And judging by these consumers at the show, Les Hendricks and Carol Bishop, there's not much of a public appetite for letting in that American fare.
I don't think it should be allowed in, no.
I don't believe in chlorine washed chicken and beef, all that.
You think it should be kept out of the UK altogether?
Yeah, definitely.
Animal welfare and food safety are not the biggest obstacles to a comprehensive free trade deal. That would be the National Health Service, or NHS, Britain's most highly prized and staunchly defended public service. Tony Sullivan is a retired NHS doctor in London.
We set up this petition to say Donald Trump hands off the NHS.
His petition calls for healthcare to be excluded from any free trade deal, the aim to stop American medical companies from playing a bigger role in Britain's public healthcare system. Currently, they provide some outsourced services in mental health and logistics. Opponents don't want any more American involvement in the UK's taxpayer-funded, free-at-the-point-of-use health system.
In America, as I understand it, healthcare is delivered dependent on the ability to pay. And that is what we don't want.
Many patients like David Margolese, Sue Richards and Chris Pinard wouldn't want that either. They perceive the American system as heartless and over-commercialised. They see the NHS, with all its faults, as an expression of British compassion and solidarity.
I've just always felt that the NHS is one of the greatest things about the UK, and that if you are unwell, if you do injure yourself, you will be picked up and you'll be looked after. There's none of this sitting on the side of the road, clearing your credit card while you wait to get in the back of the ambulance.
You know, we still have a bedrock of believing everybody has an equal right to good health.
And you think that would be at risk if there were a free trade agreement between the US and the UK?
I do.
The free trade agreement, it's designed to make profit gaining more efficient. That should not happen in the National Health Service.
The British government has pledged that healthcare, food safety and animal welfare will not be affected by any trade deal with the US. But, say the critics, that may depend on how desperate the UK is for a deal after Brexit. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The American Economic Association is going to hold its next annual meeting next January in San Diego, at which, for the first time, it's going to be the organization's policy that job interviews not take place in hotel rooms. Seems kind of self-evident that that's not a great idea, but until this year's conference, this past January, in a memo co-written by a Harvard economics PhD student named Catherine Holston, that was the way things were done in an academic specialty that's got a not great track record in gender and racial equality. Catherine Holston, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
First things first, I suppose, I need the primer on what this annual meeting of the American Economic Association actually is, right?
Great. So the annual meeting takes place every year in January. It is both a giant economics conference where there are seminars happening and also a very large job fair for every PhD economist who's received the PhD in that year and wants to work in any type of academic job.
So you kind of have to be there, right?
Yes.
Okay. How then did it come to pass that you found out about this interview process? Because you're not yet in that process, right, as a third year?
That's right. I'm a few years from that process. Yeah. I actually found out about it when I was about to enter grad school. And I found out because an older female economist remarked that I typically wore skirts to work and that I would need to wear a pantsuit in my interview. So I asked why that would be the case. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's because you might be sitting on the bed. And I said, why would I be sitting on the bed in my job interview? In which case she explained, you know, that this process happens. There are so many interviews happening at once. And so many of them can take place in hotel bedrooms, in which case there's obviously an odd seating arrangement that doesn't quite look like an office.
Does it not seem insane to you that this happens?
Yeah, so it did immediately seem insane to me. And I started talking to other grad students, other economists, people who had been through the process to kind of find out why this was and if I was the only person who thought it was really weird. And it turns out there were other people who thought it was a problem, but also it's just been done this way for a very long time.
Yeah. We should say in writing about this, the Wall Street Journal pointed out that Ben Bernanke remembers sitting on beds in hotel rooms. So it's been a while. Mr. Bernanke is no spring chicken.
Right.
Are you gratified by the change in tone and approach by the AEA?
I'm very happy to see the change, and I'll just say it actually came much faster than I expected when I started kind of working on this. My original goal was to just have any type of change by the time I myself was on the job market, a little selfishly, and at the time that was 5 to 6 years out, and it's only been, I guess, about a year since we started talking about this.
Economics, we should say, and this came out sort of last year after this conference, economics is challenged in a lot of ways in terms of diversity and gender equality and all those kinds of things.
That's right. And it's actually surprising to a lot of people that the percentage of women in in economics as full professors, as PhD students. A lot of those statistics, it's worse than many of the natural sciences. And also, we haven't seen a good amount of increase over the past few decades.
What's your area of study?
I study macroeconomics and finance, and I'm interested in inequality.
You're looking for a job in academia, or what are you going to do?
Yeah, I'll be interviewing for academic jobs going through this process in about 2 to 3 years.
Well, best of luck to you. Catherine Holston, a third-year economics PhD student at Harvard, talking about the memo she wrote, which got the AEA to change its policies. Catherine, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
One of his friends says the best way to debate Milton is to wait until he's not in the room.
Milton Friedman and the rise of The Economist. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 237 today, 0.9%, closed at 26,355. The NASDAQ advanced 102 points, 1.3%, 79.76. The S&P 500 tacked on 31 points, 1%, 29.37. YouTube, we did up at the top of the program, ultimate parent company Alphabet closed up 1% today. Shares of the messaging and collaboration software company Slack closed up 8% in regular trading, lost those gains after hours. Beat second quarter estimates. Weak earnings, though, coming for the third quarter. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did a story the other day about how often the R word is popping up in conversation and whether we can actually talk ourselves into a recession. Maybe was the upshot, but the fact is we're talking about one and that's making people think about one. So even though we don't know when it's going to happen, we ask people to tell us what they are thinking about the economy maybe slowing down.
I'm Dan Huckle from Ridley Park, Pennsylvania. My wife and I and our 11-month-old daughter live with my father-in-law in his twin home. Initially, we were really excited to jump into searching for our first home, but over the last 6 months or so, we've become a lot less aggressive because we can see and feel the uncertainty with the economy, and we're really concerned that the volatility could impact us as new homeowners. We're thinking it may be best to wait and see if prices and interest rates continue to decrease while we can still put money into our savings.
My name is Mark Knutson from Hunterdon County, New Jersey. In 2008, I was 47 years old, and I wasn't really tracking my 401k and my IRA, and was shocked when those portfolios really dropped and didn't recover for almost 3 to 4 years. Now, I don't really have the luxury of time, so I have transferred all of our 401k IRA rollovers to a new financial manager. He and his staff are a little bit more focused on balancing out the highs and the lows. It really gets to be quite nerve-wracking, especially as you try to approach retirement.
My name is Heather Phillips, and I live in Alameda, California. The other day, my husband and I were sitting around the dining room table talking about dreams and big life goals. We both want to have kids, so the topic of timing came up, and I asked him, when do you want to start trying? And he responded, end of next year, which surprised me with how specific it was. But after we talked about it, we agreed. We're financially stable. We have a house and two incomes. But I realized that that can change in an instant. So until we have some more certainty, we're going to add more to our savings account and wait and see.
Hit us up at marketplace.org. Let us know how you feel when you hear the word recession. So far in the program today, we've heard from how many economists, do you think? A couple at least, right? But perhaps in the land of public policy, economists maybe get too much attention? That idea and the consequences thereof is the subject of a new book called The Economist's Hour by Binyamin Applebaum. He's also an economics writer for The New York Times. Binyamin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I will point out by way of getting going here that it has not always been the way it is right now with economists in the society and this economy. And by way of description, I want you to give me the anecdote with which you start the book, one Paul Volcker.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing story. When Paul Volcker first started at the Federal Reserve, he worked basically as a human calculator in an office deep inside the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in the early 1950s. And he told his wife one night that he didn't think he had a future at the Fed, that as an economist, he was always going to be consigned to being essentially, you know, a worker bee at this institution that was run by financial market types, businessmen. There was even an Iowa hog farmer there, and he didn't think that he had much chance of getting ahead.
And lo and behold, 30 years later, he winds up running the place. And we all know Paul Volcker now is the guy who beat inflation and all of that stuff. With the understanding that you wrote a 300-something page book on this, how did it come to pass that from Volcker in 1950, whatever, to sort of the Great Recession, economists started to wield unbelievable power?
Yeah, this book is the story of a revolution, a quiet but really important revolution that gets underway in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, where economists begin to exert this tremendous influence over policymaking, first in the United States, gradually around much of the rest of the world. Their ideas begin to take hold. They themselves are installed as policymakers, Volcker being a primary example of that phenomenon. And there's a turn toward markets, market-oriented policies that they really lead and implement.
And there's a guy who comes out of the University of Chicago who leads that charge specifically toward markets, right?
Milton Friedman is the most important figure in this revolution. He's this elfin libertarian, this, you know, vivacious public speaker who, you know, wins every debate he enters, basically. One of his friends says the best way to debate Milton is to wait until he's not in the room. And, you know, even his enemies take that point for the most part. He's just very compelling, charismatic, and he has this simple prescription for all manner of public policy problems, which is that government should get out of the way and allow market-based solutions to do the work of allocating resources and allowing people to lead their lives.
Tell me the story of Milton Friedman and the draft, conscription.
This, to me, is an amazing story. Really, the first place where these economists are successful in reshaping public policy is that they play really the key role in convincing President Nixon to end military conscription in the United States. In the period after World War II, the United States every year drafts tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young men to meet its need for soldiers. And Friedman and some of his colleagues argue that this is the wrong way to build an army. What you should do instead is pay people as much as you need to get them to volunteer for military service. Someone like Elvis Presley, who can make more money in the private sector, should be free to go sing and everyone will be better off. And someone else can serve in place of Sergeant Presley and, you know, get paid for doing that. And that will be their career, too.
Before the era of efficient markets and Milton Friedman and Paul Volcker, for that matter, how did we make the decisions that economists have been making for us for decades?
To some extent, the answer is that these decisions were made, you know, sort of in an undisciplined form of economic thinking. But to some extent, it's also the case that there were different priorities. And one of the best examples of this is antitrust law. The government said, we don't necessarily want oil to be available at the lowest possible price. We don't necessarily want a single company to provide all the oil. We want to preserve the viability of small businesses. We want to preserve the viability of democracy by limiting the size of large corporations. We have concerns other than economic efficiency. And what happens during this revolution is that those concerns are displaced. And antitrust law, again, to take this example, comes to be focused solely on the question of, are consumers getting goods at the lowest possible price?
And yet, economists and the thinking that they bring to our social policy debates still carry enormous sway, no?
I think economics has an important role to play in our public policy debates. I think where we go wrong is in privileging economic ideas about what the goals of public policy should be. Economists really preached the idea that inequality was fundamentally unimportant. They said, if you get rid of extreme poverty and you allow the cards to fall where they may, you don't really need to worry about how much more this person has than that person. And that was fundamentally wrong. It turns out that inequality is really important. It's a problem in and of itself. And I think the solution is for public policy to be focused on reducing inequality. Economists can help in that process. They have enormously valuable tools at their disposal. It's a rigorous way of thinking about the costs and benefits of public policy problems. But we need, as a society, to decide what the goals of public policy should be. And specifically, I think, to engage the reduction of inequality as a primary goal.
Benjamin Applebaum is an editorial writer for The New York Times, also now an author of a book called The Economist's Hour. It is, I will tell you, and this is not just me, a marketplace geek, saying this, it's fascinating. It's totally, totally fascinating. Benjamin, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Richard Nixon, Milton Friedman, and the draft are in the excerpt of Binya's book that we've got for you online, marketplace.org, of course. This final note on the way out today, in which Bill Dudley, until about a year ago, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, tries to walk back his op-ed from a week ago, in which he said the Fed should not enable President Trump's trade war, and that maybe Chair Powell and the gang should think about the 2020 election when making their policy decisions. Dudley wrote another op-ed today in which it's not clear he did the walking back that he thinks he did. While he does say the Fed should never be motivated by political considerations, he also said, and this is a quote, remember this is supposed to be the walk back, quote, the Fed needs to be cautious. It does not inadvertently enable the president's trade war. So you decide. Check it out. It's on Bloomberg. Also got to say here, the actual Fed says politics just are not a factor in its decision making. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 237 today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ up 102, 1.3%. S&P 500 tacked on 31 points. That is 1%. Our media production team includes Sarah Breguer, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.